Welcome to Inside the Spec. We are the podcast that bridges the gap between building product manufacturers and the architects who specify them. Each episode brings you unfiltered insights into how architects find, evaluate, and specify building materials. I'm your co-host, Megan Kavinsky, and CEO of Point to Point. We're an advertising agency focused in securing the architect's spec through results-focused marketing. And I'm joined by my co-host, Vardhan Mehta, a second-gen architect and founder of AceLab. AceLab is an AI-driven product selection platform that brings architects and manufacturers together early in the design process.
Whether you're a manufacturer looking to better serve the architectural community or a supplier seeking to understand the evolving needs of design professionals, Inside the Spec delivers actionable intelligence straight from the source. Inside the Spec, because understanding how architects think is the first step to becoming the architect standard.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Inside the Spec. I'm your host, Megan Kavinsky. I'm the CEO of Point to Point, and I'm joined by my co-host, Vardhan Mehta. He is CEO of AceLab. And today, we've got Adam Gale, and this guy has done it all. Currently, he is the principal at Superlative, but before that, he served pretty much every role that you could have in an architecture firm. He's been a project manager, a designer, project architect, lead administrator, BIM coordinator, construction administrator. He's done public projects. He's done private projects. He's done work in higher ed, office, hospitality, residential, commercial, retail, healthcare, athletic facilities. And that's not even saying it all. So he's obviously got a wealth and a depth of experience that we're excited to be able to share with you today. But let's start with our favorite first question, which is, Adam, why did you become an architect?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. There's a pretty straightforward answer there. It was really a relatively traditional path for me. I was definitely the kid who played with Legos, who loved to draw, who loved to build and tinker, all of the, you know, the tropes that go along with everybody saying, you're going to be an architect one day. And, you know, I like to joke, I always make the joke in conversation with people that, of course, what did I do when it was time to declare a major in college? I went and I applied to be a civil engineer. And I very quickly found out that that was a little too much math and science for me. I love those subjects, but I really needed the hands-on and the creativity. And so I switched into a summer program for architecture to change my major, and I never looked back. It was definitely the right fit, and is something that has really been, you know, a profession that has been a medium to take a lot of my interests and kind of combine it into something that I get to experience and utilize every day in practice. So, you know, from a traditional standpoint, I think people had me pegged pretty early on, even before I knew it myself, but it's come full circle, and here I am.
Yeah, that Lego story, you know, we do hear that. And I'm curious, are you still a Lego fan, still building today, or did architecture replace that in your life?
Yeah. No, not at all. You know, if I could pan the camera here, you'd see quite a few Legos in the background. We've got the flowers and the architecture collection and the freestyle stuff, and then even getting into it with the kiddos these days. So Yes, very, very much still a part of my life.
That's great. I have a Star Wars thing on my kitchen counter, along with a ski slope, you know, that my son and I are very proud of.
Perfect. It's beautiful.
Yep. All right. Well, today what we're talking to Adam about is vision meets reality. You know, what your vision is and what you want to design. And then there's real life, the market. And how does that gap get bridged? How does that magic happen? So, you know, the balance between innovation and practicality, right? So let's get into really talking about your design is pushing the limits. You know, you've got this dream project that's really like out there, and everyone's starting to get kind of nervous about the product selection and, you know, what the boundaries of this project and what's possible versus the dream. What convinces you to trust that a product is actually going to work in a situation like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And honestly, I think the most straightforward answer is, can I see it and can I touch it? And is it something that I can, you know, not just wrap my head around, but actually see an application? And so a demo is always a great solution for me to take a look at something and say, okay, I've seen it. I've seen, you know, when I bang on it, when I walk around it, what it looks like. I know this is going to perform. That's kind of the number one, the gold standard. You know, we don't always get that sort of opportunity when we're speccing a material. You know, we've certainly had the extremes of manufacturers flying, you know, this is back in my first job, the principal of our firm to Germany to check out the factory of a product that we were looking to use that hadn't been used in the States. And that's an extreme end where we're able to actually see how it gets made. But sometimes just kind of sending us a sample or being willing to construct kind of a micro scale mock-up so that we can actually see it before it goes into a building, you know, that's really the gold standard. And again, when we're not afforded those opportunities, you know, is there something that we can still see and touch? Can we maybe go to a project where this has been used before and just kind of lay eyes on it, see it in the field after it's been performing for a few years? What does it look like? Is it still holding up? So that's the thing that we like to do the most. You know, if that's not an opportunity, then it comes down to, okay, can we look at warranties here? And, you know, can we look at product data and at least see some pictures and things like that? So we get a little bit of those elements. But ultimately, if it's something that we can kind of pick up and really feel and even share with our owners so that they have a level of confidence, that's really where we prefer to be, especially if it's a product that, you know, we haven't used or hasn't been used in our area before.
Mm-hmm. We started talking about Legos, which I feel like are a really good way into the subject. And I think after entering the architectural practice, for me, the thing that was really exciting to look back to Legos was like, you're the architect, you're the owner, you're the contractor, you can do anything you want. But then, of course, the, you know, as an architect, the reality hits. So when you have a crazy innovative design choice, regardless of if it's the entire project as a whole or if it's for a product from Germany that hasn't really been used in the States yet, and you're really trying to tell the client, like, that's what's truly important for the design intent, but the client just wants to play it safe for their own reasons. How do you navigate that as an architect?
Yeah, well, so I think it's got to be a balance. I mean, there's certain things we're always balancing: schedule, budget, quality, things like that. And so it's really our job as the design team to be our owner's advocate and to be the steward of their budget and make sure that they're getting something that meets their project needs, but of course is also going to have a life cycle to it, and that it's going to be able to be maintained. It's going to have a high level of impact, but it's not going to be a budget breaker or something like that. And so I think a lot of times, you know, we really want to excite our clients. It's not like we're trying to defend a design decision. We never want to get into that sort of relationship with them. We want them to be bought in and to have their trust, and really for them to be enthusiastic about the decisions that we as a design team are helping to make with them. So, you know, ultimately it's their project, and they have to have that buy-in. They have to feel like the space that we're going to be in is really truly our space. And so I think once we've established that, some of those conversations start to become a little bit easier. And, you know, I'm generalizing here, but a lot of buildings are very similar. And there's, you know, huge chunks of buildings that are more or less the same. And a lot of that stuff happens inside the walls. And so, you know, as we're trying to be stewards of our clients' budgets, we want to make sure the things that we don't need to be, you know, super creative and crazy about, that, like, let's just let that be. And then let's focus on where we really can have an impact. And I think for us, that means looking at the holistic vision of the project and, you know, where is the budget being spent? What do we have to do to make the building and the faces function to meet programmatic needs, you know, to provide some impact, to make sure we have those safe spaces? And then where are the areas where we can make a larger impact? And that can be something as simple as, you know, paint on a wall. That's one of the most economical ways to make a large impact. And if somebody doesn't like it, you can always paint over it. So that's kind of like a step one. It can be something a little more nuanced, as maybe having something that's a little bit, you know, nicer finished piece of millwork that's visible from three rooms. And so we've spent a little bit of extra money, but we're kind of getting three rooms worth of impact as opposed to it being in just one space. And similarly, you know, do we locate some of these impact moments in high traffic areas? So you know, the lobby of a building is going to be, people are coming in and out, everybody's going to see what's in there. So maybe we spend a little bit more in there, maybe we go a little bit crazy in there, we play it safe for, you know, your office where you have to be every day just in case something doesn't work out. And so I think, you know, there are things like that. Sometimes it might be just, hey, we have a really big surprise and it's the tile in the bathroom. Or in our last office, we had this crazy wallpaper in the bathroom. And so, you know, the office was very standard, but you walk into this one room and you're just like, oh my goodness, you know, what's going on in here? And these surprises, these sort of moments of whimsy, that's a way that we can kind of get that buy-in that we talked about and really kind of get somebody excited about the project. And that helps to break down those barriers of like, we've never done this before. So, you know, we're a little bit concerned, and it changes that mentality to, that's really cool. We're really excited about that. We want more of that. You know, are there opportunities to do more of that? And so it's very much the process of just building that trust together, you know, finding those moments where it's appropriate to diverge from our standard building, you know, design practices. And that's what makes each project unique. So that's how we try to go about it every opportunity we get.
That's really well said. I mean, I think it's like you have to pick your battles as an architect so much. And if you really focus on what's truly meaningful for a project, chances of you being able to get that from the owner are generally higher. Yeah, that's super interesting.
So Adam, following up on that, you know, you've done all this work to get alignment, but and you think you're on the same page, but there's still those times where you just get dealt that like devastating blow, right? Where like you just can't get the product approved, and it sort of ruins the vision for everything that you're doing. Like, what's your most devastating loss, right?
Oh my goodness. I mean, yeah, it's probably, you know, time, if I'm being perfectly honest. You know, we go down the road with something that everybody feels is amazing, and then we get to this point and it's like we have to stop and pivot or go backwards. And so, you know, if I'm being perfectly honest, it's probably the time that was spent to get to wherever we were. But I think a lot of times it is that sort of enthusiasm. I mean, I can think of an example where we were working on an office building and we had this really spectacular sliding glass door for their conference room where there's very, very minimal sight lines on mullions. And it just looked like it was a continuation of their main space. But of course, it was, you know, an acoustically private conference room. And when we got both pricing and engineering back on the product that we had spec'd, you know, pricing was astronomical and the structure was actually going to be so great that, you know, we weren't even going to be able to have that big glass expanse because we didn't have the space. So, you know, that one in particular was really devastating because it was kind of the focal point of the project. And so we had to pivot and, you know, we were able, thankfully, with a little bit of kind of internet research and looking around, we found a similar sliding glass door product. And, you know, it wasn't quite the same. It wasn't kind of quite as spectacular, but it still achieved everything we were looking for it to achieve. And it was significantly less cost and, you know, it made the structure work. And so I think ultimately, because we were able to achieve the same goal, it was a perfectly fine product substitution, but there's just kind of always this moment of, we have this momentum, we have this excitement, and there's this thing that comes in that completely deflates that. And we're having to like start pushing the ball up the hill again. And it, you know, it can taint a whole project. And so, you know, I feel like we were lucky in that one that we were able to come up with something that still met the end goal, that still had the client very thrilled at the end. But my goodness, you know, it's just, it's expectation setting, I think, a lot of the time. I use that example and I compare it to kind of the illusion of curved glass. I think a lot of people walk by buildings where you see, you know, air quotes, curved glass, and it's not in fact curved glass, it's faceted. But if you're standing far enough away, it looks like it's curved. And so again, as design professionals, it's our job to kind of find those opportunities where we're almost making a little bit of magic or, you know, an illusion happen, but we're sort of achieving that goal. And so, man, that's, you know, we hope that we don't have to get to that point, but if we do, that's our job to do so.
I was going to say architects as magicians, right?
That's right. Yeah. If this architecture thing doesn't work out, I might have a second career.
Yeah. Bird flying around. So that example that you gave, the reason that the vision didn't come to life, it sounded like maybe the performance criteria changed or the space changed on the structural outside that changed the requirements for what you were looking for the product to deliver, plus cost. So there was performance and price in that case. Like, what are other common reasons that you don't get the product in that you want? Is it availability? Is it contractor preference? I mean, you know, is it getting flipped? Do you ever lose at that point, like the vision for the project based on, you know, a spec getting changed? Like, what are the other things that occur that get in the way?
Absolutely. I mean, it's almost always budget or schedule driven, but yes, I think everything you listed there are reasons where something may happen. And a lot of the time it is either a you know, value engineering type solution, or it even can be, you know, when we get bids back from contractors and, you know, numbers look great, and then all of a sudden we get our specifications to review during construction administration and it's a different product, and it's, you know, it's an equal, it meets all the same ASTM standards and things like that, but it doesn't look the same, or the attachment detail is slightly different, and now, you know, what was a reveal is something that flanges over. And so yeah, there are definitely things like that where we try to be in control of that as much as possible to limit it. But if it's a budget-driven issue, sometimes, unfortunately, we are not in control of that. So yeah, I think everything you listed is a reason where something has changed somewhere along the line of a project.
And Adam, generally in situations where you're not trying to reinvent the wheel, where you've got your firm standards and those are reliable, like what's the reasoning behind that? Like, what makes you keep returning back to the same manufacturer? And on the other side, like, what are the types of experiences where, like, you know, you go through it once and for you or for anybody on your team, the feedback is we're not ever going to use this manufacturer again?
Yeah. I mean, I think ultimately it's, does the product perform? You know, we've installed it, we've used it, and we've never had an issue. I can think of like underlayment to concrete slabs that we pour, and there's a product that we use, and I've never in, you know, 15 plus years had a problem with it. And so that is my basis of design. You know, I'm certainly willing to look at others, but I know that this one works because I've got the experience with it. And so that's kind of like number one. You know, if a product does fail, is the manufacturer going to stand behind it? We don't want the product to fail, but in the event that it does, is the owner going to get a replacement that isn't going to cost them anything? And, you know, is there going to be a huge headache to get there? Or is the manufacturer just going to say, yeah, that one's on us. You know, we're going to make this as pain-free as we can, because we know just any type of renovation to go and fix something that's already completed, that's going to be invasive and a nuisance in and of itself. So I think, you know, that's kind of number one and two. You know, number three is probably the type of attention and support that we get from the product rep. And, you know, I don't mean, are we getting calls every week or anything like that, but simple things like, is it making my job easier? You know, when I call, do I get a quick response? Do I get sent the correct information? You know, do I get directed to the appropriate people if they don't have the answer? I don't expect them to know everything. And so I think those three things are typically what I look for the products that I like to keep in our spec as basis of design. And then to answer the second part of your question, Vardhan, you know, certainly if the product fails, then it's not something that I want to put in there. And if the manufacturer is not willing to stand behind it, then, you know, absolutely not. I never want to use that product again. But I think a lot of the time, too, it can be, you know, are you getting a product that's kind of being pushed to you, but then you're not really getting the information that you need? Or, you know, you're getting promised that, hey, this thing is the gold standard and you can use it anywhere. And then you request information for, you know, hey, I'd like to use this in, you know, a hospital project I'm working on. And all of a sudden they say, oh, well, it doesn't work in that environment. And so I think just making sure that we're not getting misinformation. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I'm acting as my client's advocate, and I want to make sure that nothing goes wrong. But in the event that something does, I want to make sure that they're covered and that it's going to be as painless as a process as we can.
Yeah, I find that super interesting. I mean, like with all the three reasons you mentioned, there's like an interesting element of time attached to it. So like one, there may be a very long feedback loop as an architect to you chose something either new or repeat. and you're seeing, you're hearing about how it's actually doing on site in the project, how it's being used. Number two, I feel like sometimes when, you know, we think about this process of selection or specification, you can sort of think as a manufacturer, like that's where your responsibility ends. But there's so much after that where you still have to continue the support in order to retain that relationship with the architect. So I find that super interesting. And maybe just on that point, like just, you know, the time aspect of everything between an architect and a manufacturer, has a manufacturer ever like ghosted you for support or anything after a product has been installed? Or maybe like if an issue arises, then the owner is like trying to get you to talk to the manufacturer. Has that ever happened in your experience?
I don't think I've ever been just like ghosted by anybody. You know, I have had actually for a product that I liked, I've had the company go out of business, and there was a couple of years in between, you know, the project where we had used their product and we were going to go back and use them again. And, you know, we picked up the phone and called and were like, this company doesn't exist anymore. And so, you know, we weren't going to use that product, but at the same time, you know, we're like, oh my gosh, I hope this performs on the project we have it on, because there is no support to go to. So, you know, I think that's the only specific example I can think of. There is always, if something goes wrong, I feel like there's always the finger pointing of, you know, well, it wasn't my product, it was the one that it's interfacing with. And, you know, there is sort of this detective work that sometimes we have to go through. And my MO is, I really don't care whose fault it is at the outset. You know, the very first thing we need to do is find a solution. And so manufacturers that are, you know, are willing to have the conversation and that are willing to arrive at the solution, and then, you know, then we can go figure out kind of on the back end, I guess, you know, who ultimately is accountable for that. That's the type of conversation that I want to have to work with. And that is difficult to come by. You know, I think a lot of people just immediately go into self-defense mode, self-preservation mode. And, you know, I much prefer, let's make this open. Let's just figure out how to solve the problem, and then we'll figure out everything else.
So on the warranty / install, one thing I haven't heard you talk about yet in terms of your evaluation is how important is how the company honors the warranty in terms of like, do they have an installer network? Are they out there inspecting the install? Like, are you looking at these things as like proof points that they're going to last? You know, what are some of those things that manufacturers could bring forward more when they're trying to get their product, you know, specified by you and in this sort of, you know, vision meets reality, you know, construct that would make it more likely that they're going to make sure that it holds, right?
Yeah. I mean, warranty is a big one. If you're willing to stand behind your product, you know, that definitely gives not only me, but an owner a level of confidence that, yes, this is probably a good product if they're willing to say for, you know, for 10 years, we're not going to have any issues with it and we'll take care of it if there is. So that's definitely a big one. For certain products, I think it depends on what we're talking about. You know, if we're talking about maybe a countertop versus like a building envelope system, that's order of magnitude cost and, you know, level of work to have to fix something like that should something go wrong. And so for certain things, having, you know, qualified installers, whether it's having been certified through a training program, whether it's writing into a spec a minimum number of jobs or years that somebody has been performing this work, you know, sometimes that is a piece of what will give us that level of comfort. You know, sometimes we do have to just sort of build that trust with the manufacturer. If it's a brand new product, it hasn't been on the market long, it might be, well, what sort of testing have you done? You know, are there any products that you can just show us examples of, and we can just, maybe we can call, you know, whoever's maintaining that building and just have a conversation with how is that product performing? So there are different ways to go about that and to sort of get that level of comfort with a product. But yeah, warranty does go a long way. And I think having a manufacturer that's willing to stand behind their product, it means a lot. That's a lot of comfort for sure.
Yeah. The other thing that I'm hearing, and I want to go back to in this conversation, is value engineering. And you talk about a time suck, right? And you talk about vision meets reality and, you know, what happened to my vision. You know, go talk to us about what that process and how it really works between you and the contractor and the building owner, and you know, maybe demystify that a bit for manufacturers so that they could better understand what type of support they need, you need from them, or how can they get out ahead of being vulnerable to value engineering when they know that that's something that might happen? What do you need to prevent that? You know, just help us understand how to support that area better.
Yeah, I love to have everybody who's going to be involved with the project that we know about. I want them to the table as early as possible because we really need to be setting expectations. We really need to be getting firm understandings, and we need to make sure that the understanding that I have is the same understanding that my owner or client has. And that's the same understanding that our contractor has. And, you know, that trickles down to their subs and, of course, the manufacturers. So I think having everybody on the same page when it comes to design intent is really important. And the earlier we can get people to the table, typically the easier it is to achieve that sort of consensus or understanding. I think how manufacturers can support us as design professionals is whenever they're able to get to the table, hopefully it's early, but even when it's not, to provide the actual materials and the actual specifications for these products so that we can go to our designs and say, yes, that makes sense. Or, you know, oh, we need to afford extra space, or we need to make sure that has power. We didn't realize that this needed to be on a dedicated circuit, you know? And so as we start to refine these details, we need to know every piece of information about this. And of course, that's going to have cost implications. And so if we have a CM on board, or if somebody is pricing the project, they need to know all of these parts and pieces. I mean, I've seen it literally as extreme as us. We had a bathroom in a project and we got a cost estimate back, and, you know, there was nothing in there for a toilet or a sink or anything like that. And we asked our CM, we said, why aren't you carrying, you know, dollars for that? And they said, well, it wasn't drawn. What's a bathroom? What did you expect was going to be in there? And so that's the extreme example of it. But, you know, when it starts to get down to some of the hardware or some of the nuanced components of these things, those can be the surprises that, you know, when we get to really a true cost exercise, once we've got construction documents, those are the budget busters. You know, those are kind of the little unknowns that either can early on be just a placeholder figure that, you know, sometimes can kind of price us into VE before we even know what's in there. But certainly once we know it's in there and it's got a price to it, you know, that can be something that sort of derails that project. So if we're able to get some of those specifics early on, then we're able to communicate that with everybody. And that's something that will at least have those expectations set so that it's not a surprise down the road. We can make the educated decision to say, yes, we need this product to be in here, or, hey, we would love this product to be in here, but I guess we're open to an alternate because this is going to be cost prohibitive, you know, or something as simple as just, hey, we can't have this. We'd love to have it in there, but we know we can't do it. And that way we're not wasting manufacturers' time. I mean, I don't want a manufacturer to spend a whole lot of time getting me information on their project or product only to have it not end up in the project. I mean, that's not really fair to them either. So the relationship really does go both ways. And again, as early as we can get that information into the project, I think the faster we can make those decisions and determinations.
Do you ever go back to that team, you know, the GC, the CM, you know, whoever, and say, like, guys, if you're looking, I know you're going to look to get cost out of this, like, here are the places, like, my non-negotiables, right? Or here are the place, like, the places where I would appreciate it if you stayed away from, you know, like, do you guide that conversation at all, just knowing that it's going to happen?
Yeah. Most of the time, yes. You know, if it's a contractor we'd worked with before, it's a very easy conversation to have. And we just sit down at the onset and say, hey, we absolutely need this. You know, this is something the client has said has to be in here. Just don't even think about it. And, you know, save yourself the time. So yes, where we can, we do. And likewise, and sometimes this shows up in a specification. Sometimes it is just maybe during a page turn meeting, we'll kind of verbally mention it, but we'll say, this is something that's really important to us. You know, we would love to have this in here. We are open to equivalent alternates, but it's got to be a true equivalent, or, you know, it has to have a very specific design aesthetic. And you know, so we'll try to qualify that, because it is few and far between where there's something just very, very specific that has to be in there. There's certainly times where that is the case. But a lot of times, it kind of goes back to, is it achieving the effect and the end goal of the user? And then there's probably a couple different ways to get there.
And do manufacturers ever come to you and say, like, how do we work together to make sure that I don't get value engineered out of this spec? You know, are people approaching you that way? How is that received from your end? Do you view that as a benefit that they're being so direct and forthright? Or are you like, yeah, you and everyone else that I'm talking to, you know, what's your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably a fine line. I mean, yes, manufacturers have reached out before, and you know, thankfully, it's manufacturers that I have a history of working with, and I trust their products, and so it's very easy to have those conversations. And yeah, they do. They say we're very happy to spend a lot of time and effort upfront to get you all of this information. You know, we request that you put either X, Y, and Z in your spec, or, you know, hey, are there a couple things that we can just kind of be firm about? And it's a conversation. You know, we certainly never want to say to our client that, like, this is the only way you can do it when there's other ways out there. I mean, that's ultimately who we're accountable to. And it's not the manufacturers as much as we like to preserve those relationships. So it's a fine line. It's a gray area. You know, I think at the end of the day, the conversation is about, well, you know, can you give me a product that meets the user's design needs and meets these budgetary needs? And so it's kind of a detailed homework assignment, but oftentimes if manufacturers can meet those requirements, they're going to be the ones selected because they're meeting those requirements. And it has nothing to do with any sort of relationship. You know, it's just everything is ethical and above board, but because they're doing honestly the bare minimum, it's like they're the ones who are going to be selected because they're making it easy on everybody. So yeah, I think that is a conversation that can be had. You know, I have had it go way too far the other way, where a manufacturer is called up and ultimately their product was not selected. And, you know, it was not something that I even had a choice in. The owner made the decision and they're very upset with me. And they said, you know, hey, you know, we did all this work and our product didn't get used. And, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you taxing us? And it's like, it's not a personal decision. This is what my client wants. And I am responsible to give my client what they want. So, you know, if you want to have the conversation with them, you probably don't want to go down that path, but like I'm not in control of it at that point.
You alluded to, Adam, like sometimes manufacturers, you know, requesting for you as the architect to add those landmines into the spec, which automatically eliminates the competitors and so on. And I think you also mentioned, like, sometimes if you know the manufacturer and if you understand, like, they will actually end up being the right fit for the project, you have no problem adding those in. But I would imagine if it's a newer manufacturer saying, hey, okay, I'm going to help you with all of these things, but then you need to add these landmines in, that might be a red flag for you. What are some things that you wish manufacturers would, like, stop doing in those, like, earlier stages of a project, regardless of if it's an old manufacturer or if it's like somebody entirely new?
Yeah, there's not that much. You know, thankfully, I'm typically not hounded by people. I know they're doing their job when they want information about our products and, you know, what's the schedule, what's the budget, who's the CM and all of this stuff. And some of that stuff I don't know. And so, you know, I'm happy to share that information when I have it, but you don't need to be contacting every week for all of this stuff. It's like, that pump the brakes just a little bit, please. You know, I appreciate your enthusiasm. So that's a piece of it. I think a lot of times, you know, and this maybe goes against what I said a few minutes ago, but, you know, they really want a very fine level of specificity early on because they're trying to pick up a product and they require, you know, all the specs for that. And it's like, guys, we're in conceptual design. We don't know that information yet. You know, that's going way too deep. I can't plug that in. We're just not there yet. So I think it's almost like an over eagerness sometimes, you know, and I get it because the relationship gets reversed too, where we've got a very short view schedule and we say, hey, we need this in a couple of days. Can you do it? And they're like, why didn't you come to us 2 months ago? So it goes both ways. I want to be sensitive to that. But I think ultimately it just comes down to, you know, the majority of the time for our manufacturers, the products we select are either performance-based or they are something that our owner really, really wants. And so it's not a personal decision. You know, it's not a vendetta against any sort of product or anything like that. But if we're working on a lead project, it's got to meet certain sustainability goals. And those are the sorts of things that get written into our spec. And so, you know, your product has to be able to meet that, and it has to be able to fit within our budget, and we have to be able to procure it within a timely manner. And so those are really the items. And, you know, I think the overzealousness, you know, we'll take some of that. I get it's part of the relationship, but certainly, you know, we're happy to share that information, and we will reach out. So we don't need probably the constant reminders and knocks on our door.
I'm glad you brought up sustainability, because I think that might be a good way for us to sort of, you know, end the conversation here in terms of design meets reality, right? So, you know, sustainability can get smiles, it can get eye rolls, you know, like what are some watchouts that you would advise manufacturers when endeavoring to have sustainable conversations or positioning of their products?
I think a lot of time it's, let's look at the whole picture. So what is the, you know, cradle to grave, or even cradle to cradle, of these, you know, so-called sustainable products? I think a handful of years ago, you know, sustainable or green was a really, really huge buzzword in our industry. And thankfully, it's less of a buzzword and a little bit more common practice in today's industry, although, you know, there's still certainly a huge push to get projects more and more sustainable. So I think when manufacturers are looking at this sort of conversation, it's, you know, how does their manufacturing process fit into this? It's one thing if we are getting, you know, a single credit for a sustainably rated system that we're pursuing. That's of course great, but that's kind of the tip of the iceberg. And we follow that up with, does your product have, you know, electronic product declarations to go along with it? So now we have tangible information that says you have tested this product, and here's the life cycle cost of this project, and here's the impact to the environment. Because a lot of our clients are more educated about sustainability in today's day and age, and simply having a material that says, hey, we're from recycled plastic, that doesn't move the needle for them anymore. Because how many, you know, gallons of fuel did you have to spend to get that recycled plastic to the factory? And, you know, how much effort did you have to take to recycle that plastic? And then what happens at the end of the useful life of that product? Does it just get tossed in the dumpster? Does your company have a recycling program? You know, what, how does this fit into really the life cycle of the entire product and the product chain? And so we've kind of taken it to that next step and just simply saying, you know, hey, you can get this single credit, or hey, we're green. That doesn't really move the needle. And so there needs to be a greater understanding of what it really truly means to be sustainable and how this is fitting into the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. So EPDs are important, right? Because EPDs are costly, right? You know, like, yeah, there's a need to get it done, but there's also a lot of investment and time that's required to get that certification. So to get it all created, right? So you would tell a manufacturer, like, it's worth it in terms of grabbing your attention or believing the, being able to get the value across to your customer, to your client?
It is. I mean, I would say it's not the end all be all. It's like, if you don't have this, that's not going to necessarily be an issue. But if I'm comparing apples to apples and one product has it and the other one doesn't, likely going to give the nod to the one that does.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, Adam, you're also saying that the level of education of the average architect or designer about sustainability has evolved greatly, which also has an effect on manufacturers and, like, what's expected of them.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that statement. You know, I think people are definitely looking at what is the life cycle of materials, and what does it mean to truly be sustainable? I mean, a lot of the sustainable rating systems, things that were getting you, you know, gold and platinum ratings probably just 5 years ago, that's now the threshold for entry. And yeah, so standards are going up, which is a good thing. Right. But yeah, there's definitely a need for a greater level of understanding and a greater level of information for us as designers to take and make sure that we're really, truly putting our best foot forward when it comes to sustainability.
Yeah. I was talking to a friend who's an architect recently, and she said, you know, I'm pretty sure almost every building that we're doing could be LEED certified if I wanted to go through all the paperwork. Like, you have to be trying really hard to not be just doing sustainable design now, you know, like, you're bad at your job. So everything is moving and, you know, has moved in that direction, you know, so going along with what you said about the baseline.
Yeah.
All right, Adam. Well, that all was great. I really appreciate, you know, your focus on the vision, the reality, how do these things all work? But one last question, just to understand you a little bit better. Curious about what is your favorite building that you've been able to visit, like in real life, that you've been able to go to in person?
And why? Oh, man.
Yeah.
And why? Okay. I might have to cheat a little bit here and give you a series of buildings, but I was fortunate enough to spend a semester abroad in Vicenza, Italy. And during our spring break for that semester, we took a flight, I think, into Basel, Switzerland, and then took a drive kind of all through Switzerland and France and kind of ended up back in Italy. And so we had this amazing road trip, and we called it Corbapalooza because we're just driving to various Le Corbusier buildings along the way. And I think, I mean, there's some really spectacular buildings just in general that I've been to, but that experience as a whole, being able to spend, you know, the better part of a week driving through Europe, seeing these really, you know, some of them, like one was a gas station, and then a couple were just these massive, you know, Unité buildings, Ronchamp, just kind of the masterworks of one of the historically most important architects of our time, and getting to just kind of get all of these buildings in over the course of a week while driving through the European countryside was really, really cool. And some of these, you know, I mentioned the gas station because it's just something that, you know, you're driving by the road, you'd never really realize that is just this little unassuming building. And then, you know, you enter a place like Ronchamp and you can just like feel the historical gravity of it and just being in some of these spaces. And so I think that trip is probably the answer for that question, even though it's not a single building, if I'm allowed to do that.
Yeah. Well, thanks everybody for joining us on Inside the Spec. Hope you enjoyed the conversation with Adam today. I know that we did. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.